The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Okay, we are starting the month of September, and we have an editor from Bruce Kelly, the editor-in-chief, and he will start that off with our daily reading. History calls on June, a 15-year-old named Alana Stevenson woke up in East Palo Alto, California, ready to act. Most people on Earth still don't have the right to assemble and speak freely, but in America, Alana can, without even telling her parents. She posted a flyer on Instagram announcing a march to protest the death of George Floyd. 600 people surged into Farrell Park at the time posted on her flyer. Community elders spoke on needed changes. Then Alana, shown above, and there's a picture of the young lady. She's an African-American, and she's got a shirt on that says, "I am next." And the crowd set off for a mile walk up the University Avenue. Many didn't know that a high school student was the force behind the day. East Palo Alto is a city of 30,000 where I went to high school. In the heart of now wealthy Silicon Valley, it has had to handle harsh policing, the drug trade, poverty, and foreclosure crisis. Largely black, when I attended school there, the city is largely Latino now. A lot has changed, but one thing hasn't. Someone reminded me of East Palo's Alto history, says Alana's mom, Shauna Cease, coming around to her daughter's plan. In East Palo Alto, we value kids' voices. A few years before I enrolled, black students at Ravenswood High protested inequities in their segregated school. That's how a white kid like me ended up there, a racially mixed student body. East Palo Alto kids and their parents never were afraid to lead. They successfully campaigned for a police force of their own when the county sheriff ran roughshod. They got a toxic waste plant shut down. Now that history has found Alana, I felt like God was telling me, use your voice and use the attitude and power you have to promote protest for things that were right, she says. Police officers knelt with her to say Black Lives Matter. Their chief offered Alana support. I do too, and we hope you do as well. Okay, how about some letters this morning? How does that sound? Find your happy place. At a time when being patriotic can have a variety of definitions as well as reactions, it is lovely to be reminded of what we really do best in this country, take care of one another. And for that, I am proud to be an American. Thank you for giving us a place where we can share that feeling. Margaret McKinley, San Diego, California. Dear reader, after reading the story of your friend's lost and found wallet, I want to share that the quickest way to locate the owner of a lost wallet containing a credit card is to call the number on the back of the card. The company will call the owner and give them your contact information. The owner will probably call you immediately. Ken Hildebrand, Newport, Oregon. That's valuable information. I never thought of that. I was scammed by my best friend. There is so much wrong with our justice system that the Jonathan Walton is forced to work so hard and spend 2 years of his life trying to get his friend, Mayor Smith, convicted of conning him out of $92,000, which is obviously a crime. Talk about injustice. Sherry Faccini, Palm Beach Gardens, Florida. My thank you year. Like Gina Hamaday, I'm committed to sending thank you notes for the year, in my case, one per week. It seemed daunting to come up with 52 people to thank, but with COVID-19, I found plenty of recipients. My mailman, restaurants, my grocery store, friends, and family. No emails, just pen to paper. Something tangible to reach people during this time of isolation. I encourage more people to make 2020 their thank you year. Mr. K. Ham, Cumming, Georgia. On Dad's Trail Forever. I've been riding motorcycles since my teens. My son and I did a 10-day dirt bike tour of Cambodia, the challenging adventure of a lifetime for both of us. If given a choice between spending my last days at a rest home or dying with my boots on, doing something I love, like the author's biker dad, the choice is easy. Larry Harding, Hendersonville, North Carolina. How to find peace anytime, any place. I have thought meditation might be useful and have tried it. However, when I read the author's description of his mental chatter during a typical session, I thought, how can I possibly take anyone who doesn't like fedoras seriously? J. Gregory Bushaw, Weaverville, North Carolina. I won! Reading about the International Cherry Pie Spitting Championship took me back to the time my parents brought my best friend and me to the local cherry orchards. That evening, Cheryl spent the night and we lay in bed eating cherries and spitting the pits into the ceiling light fixture. To this day, when there are cherries on the table, we have our own private laugh. Linda Davidson, Ocean Hill, California. A little life saved, a big friend made. The hero of the story of the Central Connecticut State University football coach who encouraged his players to join the National Bone Marrow Registry. Without that incentive, this miracle would never have happened. Eileen Smith, Temple, Texas. It was the best of places, it was the worst of places. My county is rated a bit below average when it comes to amenities, and I wondered what the author would think of it. A few paragraphs later, I read he's from where I live, Oneonta, New York. I bet he thinks it's pretty terrific, like I do. Nancy Sykes, Oneonta, New York. I was so entranced by the author's account of Red Lake County, Minnesota, that I read the story twice. It painted such a wonderful picture of classic small-town America that I wanted to hop on a plane and experience for myself all Red Lake Falls has to offer. Susan Matter, Devon, Pennsylvania. Everyday Heroes. Using ink and needle, this artist helps injured and scarred patients feel whole again. And there's a picture of the gentleman tattoo artist. You wouldn't want to meet him in a dark alley. He's big, stocky, got tattoos all over and a beard. He's wearing his baseball cap on backward. He's got an apron on and a wool shirt. And Eric Catalano fills in the blanks left by empty surgery or accidents. The first fingernail tattoo started off as a joke. Mark Bertrand, 46, lost the tips of two fingers at work in 2018 when his hand became trapped in a fan belt. It's life-changing, but life-ending, he says. Doing work is harder now. Everything is just a little different. After two surgeries and occupational therapy, Bertrand decided to make light of his condition by asking Eric Catalano, an auto finance manager named turned tattoo artist, to create fingernail tattoos. The idea made everyone in the studio laugh until they saw the final result, and there's a picture of it. You would not believe it. It really does look like he has fingernails after minus the tips of his fingers. When Catalano posted a photo of the tattoos, a pair of fingernails that looked so real, no one could believe their eyes. He had no idea the image would eventually be viewed by millions of people around the world. The viral photo pushed Catalano, 40, further into the world of paramedical tattooing. Now people with life-altering scars come from as far away as Ireland to visit his shop. They enter Eternal Ink, looking for the artistic healing they saw online. Using flesh-toned inks and a needle, Catalano transforms his clients' view of themselves. Leslie Poland, 32, a dog breeder in Oxford, Mississippi, was bitten on the face by a puppy in 2014. She underwent countless surgeries to correct a scar on her lip. Plastic surgery gave me no hope, she says, so I looked for other options. She ultimately traveled 6 hours for a session with Catalano. He camouflaged Poland's lip scar, giving her back a piece of her confidence. You don't understand until you've been through it, Poland says. It made me have a different outlook on life. Using tattoos to blend in rather than stand out is a relatively new field, but it's proving growing, thanks in part to intricate cosmetic and plastic surgery. In fact, Americans spent at least $16.5 billion on cosmetic procedures in 2018. After tummy tucks, breast augmentation, and other procedures, some patients want to cover the scars that are a product of such operations. Though he's now known for his talent with intricate fingernails, Catalano uses techniques he picked up years ago while helping breast cancer survivors who wanted tattoos of aureoles, the darker areas around the nipples, after having mastectomies. Those tattoos are now among the most common paramedical requests. His grandmother had breast cancer, and her battle with the disease is one reason Catalano is so dedicated to helping those with the diagnosis. Cancer took away part of my body I can never get back, says Sarah Penberthy, a breast cancer survivor who came from Festus, Missouri, to receive aureola tattoos. I felt like I wasn't even human. Penberthy, 40, says she was grateful for her life, but felt incomplete until Catalano stepped in. He tattooed nipples and creative design of a ship's anchor on her chest, with the words, "I refuse to sink." Catalano, who inks traditional tattoos out of his studio he established more than 10 years ago, performs up to 8 reconstructive tattoos each Wellness Wednesday, drawing in nail beds on finger amputees, mocking up belly buttons after tummy tucks, and more. While he charges $100 per regular tattoo, he doesn't charge for paramedical tattoos. A GoFundMe page established last year brought in more than $16,000, allowing Catalano to donate his work. Financially, it doesn't make sense, Catalano says, but every time I see that emotion from my customers, I'm 100% sure this is something that I can't stop doing. What a wonderful thing to do. That's fantastic. Everyday Heroes again, saving a life online. And there's a picture of a young woman and an even younger boy. And the younger boy's name is gamer Riley Howard, and his mother, Sheila Riley, prevented a friend's suicide. We think of kids playing video games as being of a sort of solitary confinement, sequestered in their darkened bedrooms. In truth, they are mostly communicating with other gamers via audio or text about the action on the screen. And sometimes the chatter veers from the world of fantasy to real life. That's what happened to 14-year-old Riley Howard from East Hampton, Connecticut, last October. While playing Counter-Strike Global Offensive, he noticed that an online friend, a 13-year-old from Florida, was not his normally effusive self. Riley's hunch was confirmed when the friend messaged him. "Yo, we need to talk," Riley immediately called him. He starts to open up about what's going on in his life. "I have nothing to live for. I'm going to kill myself," Riley told NBConnecticut.com. He couldn't even talk. He was crying so much. Unable to verbally convey his anguish, his friend typed out, "Tonight is going to be the night." Suicide is a lot to throw at a high school kid. But Riley, a sophomore at the time, resolved to stay on the line for as long as he was needed. "I knew he didn't want to be alone, and I didn't want him to go," he told WFSB. "He's my friend. I didn't want him to die." For 2 hours, Riley said everything he could think of to persuade his friend to embrace life. "I kept reassuring him. 'You've got a lot to live for,' says Riley. 'I said, I'll see you tomorrow. I'm going to be playing with you tomorrow. You promise nothing is going to happen tonight.'" About that time, Riley's parents came home from dinner. He filled them in, and they contacted Florida police, who tracked down the boy. The troubled teen is doing well now, thanks to a good friend, one he never met in person, who was willing to put down the keyboard and lend an ear, says Riley's mother, Sheila Riley. "You just have to show up and talk to people and listen." How about a bunch of quotable quotes? "All you need is love, but a little chocolate now and then doesn't hurt," Charles M. Schulz, cartoonist. "I've never considered compassion a finite resource," Roxane Gay, writer. "I strive to be a skeptic, but in the best sense of the word, I question everything, and yet I'm open to anything," Amy Tan, author. "I'm just doing the best thing everyone else is right now, the best I can. My AA is a huge part of that. Sometimes it's just about talking." Sugar Ray Leonard, boxer. I didn't realize he was an alcoholic. "There are more people moving us forward than there are sowing division. I surround myself with people who have faith." Maria Shriver, journalist. In the military, you see so many examples of self-sacrifice and moral courage. In life, you don't get that many opportunities to be sure of your friends. Adam Driver, an actor, who's also a Marine. "When I stand in a blessing, my first question is, how can I be used?" Nancy Nash, a community. "If you're pretty, you're pretty. But the only way to be beautiful is to be loving. Otherwise, it's just congratulations on your face." John Meyer, musician. "Be the hardest working person you know. If you're not, someone else will be." Ian Brenning, screenwriter. Points to ponder. The answers to American problems are found by living up to American ideals, to the fundamental truth that all human beings are created equal, endowed by God with certain rights. George W. Bush, former president. Now a little humor. Life in these United States. And there's a picture of an old gentleman sitting on a bench, cartoon-wise, throwing bread crumbs to the birds. And one of the birds looks up at him and says, "Got anything else? I gave up carbs." My teenage son and I were discussing dating and relationships. To impress him upon him that I had valuable experience to share, I commented, "You know, I've been around the barn a few times." "Yeah, Mom," he said, unimpressed, "but always on the same horse." Nancy West. "Why don't toasters have a window so you can see how toasted your bread is?" That's a good question. Times I've seen my husband cry. Our wedding. The birth of our children. The time I mowed the grass too short. I walked into our living room and found our expensive decorative sofa pillow in shreds. I asked my teenage daughter whether she knew which of our three dogs were responsible. "It was Cotton," she said. "How do you know?" "I watched him." Sad after the funeral of a friend, my wife and I ducked into a Chinese restaurant for a little Szechuan to pick me up. The feel-good session all ended abruptly when I read the fortune in my cookie. You will soon be reunited with a good friend. Oh, that would be a downer. Sometimes I worry that my 9-year-old is too sweet for this world. But recently she looked at my face and said, I didn't know you could be old and get a pimple. So it turns out she'll be fine. Daughter, via text. Mom, where are you? Mom, leaving Walmart, halfway home. Why, sweetie? Daughter, you brought me to Walmart with you. Mom, oh, darn, be back in a bit. My aunt was in the hospital for hip replacement surgery and not happy about having to wear the hospital garb she'd been given. So when she was wheeled into surgery, mother ran out and brought her a nice robe to wear instead. Rather than being thankful, my aunt was appalled. You left the hospital while I was in surgery, she asked. What you had done if I had died? I'd have returned the robe, answered Mom. It really doesn't feel like September till Macy's puts their Christmas decorations up. Dear God, sometimes kids have such big questions that not just anyone can answer them. BoardPanda.com collected a few such queries from third graders. Dear God, how come you didn't invent any new animals lately? We still have just the old ones. Dear God, is Reverend Coe a friend of yours, or do you just know him through business? Dear God, who draws the lines around the countries? Dear God, how did you know you were God? Oh, that's a deep question. Dear God, I bet it's very hard for you to love all of everybody in the whole world. There are only 4 people in our family, and I could never do it. Dear God, I think a stapler is one of your greatest inventions. How to bake absolutely anything. If I could overcome my first run-in with yeast and the lopsided results, anyone can. And there's a picture of a large loaf of round loaf of bread, and it looks kind of beat up, to tell you the truth. My introduction to baking started with the home kitchen classic that cracks open the oven door for so many, Nestle Toll House chocolate chip cookies. It was the 1970s, and most of the moms in our largely Catholic neighborhood outside of Milwaukee were busy raising big families. For the girls in my house, that meant our mother made sure we knew our way around the kitchen. At the flour-dusted table, Mom taught 8-year-old me how to make cookies perfectly chewy with a crispy exterior. The big secret, always chill your dough. We crafted them by the dozen, measuring ingredients from yellow Tupperware containers and mixing everything in my mom's aqua butterprint Pyrex bowl, part of a set she'd received as a wedding gift in 1963. Friends who grew up in fresh fruit and dessert households could not get enough when they visited, and when they happened to come over when the cookie jar was empty, they were not shy about sharing their disappointments. So from a young age, I was crystal clear on the power of baked-to-perfection cookie to make people happy. Baking cookies, then brownies, cakes, and pies became my hobby, and a tasty form of social currency. First, I used my skill with butter and sugar to impress a series of teenage boyfriends. In time, the fresh goodies were left on doorsteps to welcome new neighbors and set out in the break room for co-workers. Baking was my superpower. A few years ago, I became content director for Taste of Home, the R&D sister magazine that celebrates the treasured recipes of home cooks. I'd never been more excited for a new job, but privately, I worried that my baking chops wouldn't measure up. Why? I had a secret as dark as an oven with a burned-out light bulb. While I had baked sweets my whole life, I'd never made a yeast bread from scratch. Mom couldn't help me with this one, for her store-bought frozen dough was to her go-to when she needed from-scratch bread. I understand why. Bread dough provides so many opportunities to fail. Cookies are forgiving. You can be a little off in your measurements, and trust me, those cookies still disappear from the office break room. Not the case with yeast breads. Most recipes recommend weighing ingredients carefully, down to the gram. Then there's the yeast. Yeast is fussy, the Goldilocks of ingredients. Mix in water, too cool, and it won't activate too hot. And it does. Yes, yeast is a living one-celled member of the fungus family, because it is alive. I could, of course, kill it, but unfortunately, rather easily. And don't forget that other potential failure point, the kneading. Too little kneading and the bread will be flat. But don't overdo it. Knead it too much, and the loaf will be tough and chewy. Still, this was no time for excuses. I was a baker, now one of the Taste of Home attached with my name. I may have been intimidated by bread, but as it was time, I wanted in. Getting started, I found Instagram to be a friend. A basic no-knead bread was the one I was seeing online, overlaid with dreamy filters. People described it as easy, and to be honest, the thought of removing even one intimidating variable, kneading, was enough to get me to buy 5 pounds of bread flour and dive in. I gathered everything I'd need to be prepared. Is the first rule of any baking, including my mom's trusty Pyrex. It had seen me through my first days as a baker, so I was counting on it to work its magic. I had an easy taste of home recipe all set on my iPad. I mixed the flour, salt, and yeast, and made sure the water temperature was just right, 110 to 115 degrees, before pouring it in. And then it happened, or didn't happen. I followed the instructions to the letter, but my bow didn't rise. Somehow, impossibly, it looked smaller. Sludgy, gooey, wet with a few bubbles. So sad. The Pyrex bowl didn't save me, so I had to figure out how to do it myself. Frantically gluing bread dough didn't rise yielded a likely answer. The room was too cold. This is what happens when you live in Wisconsin. But I found some solutions, too. I put the disappointing dough in the oven with the light on, a trick that provides just a bit of gentle heat. Let it try again. 3 hours later, I resisted the urge to keep checking on it like a nervous mom with a newborn. A puffy dough filled the bowl. I hadn't killed it. It was just sleeping, I guess. A quick fold, a second rise, and then my bread went into my Dutch oven and off to bake. 30 minutes later, I took it out. Sure, it was slightly misshapen, but in my eyes, it was a golden brown, crusty perfection, right down to the yeasty sweet hint of steam coming from up its top. Naturally, the first thing I did was grab my phone and hop on Instagram, positioning my beautiful dread just so in shining stream of daylight on a wooden cutting board. No one needed to know it was my first yeast bread ever, or how close it came to getting scraped into the garbage can. The online reaction started almost immediately. Heart emojis and comments like, "This looks delish," from my friends. They couldn't taste it, but virtual sharing yields its own rewards. Finally, I cut into that lovely brown crust and doled out slices to my husband and kids. Those slices led to seconds, then thirds. Each piece slathered with softened butter and a little sprinkle of kosher salt. I made my family perhaps happier with slices of warm, buttered homemade bread than I had with all the sweets combined. They were used to the cookies and brownies. This was something totally new and equally delicious. Soon enough, I was left with a butter-smeared knife, a few lonely crumbs on the cutting board, and, of course, my post on Instagram, as the only evidence of its existence. At last, I was a bread baker, despite G's best attempt to intimidate me on the first try. No more feeling inferior or afraid. Now I bake bread, homemade pizza crust regularly. Yeast and I have such a good relationship that I'm done buying the little packs. I buy it in large enough quantities to fill its own Tupperware container, and I have enough confidence to start thinking and stressing about my next difficult baking challenge. Homemade croissants. Tips for my trial and error. Read the whole recipe before you start. We've all gotten halfway through a recipe only to find we didn't have any buttermilk. Plus, a quick read can help you prepare for what's ahead, particularly if there are any techniques with which you're not familiar. Use butter at the right temperature. Most cake and cookie recipes call for softened butter, which is the right consistency for creaming with sugar. Biscuit and pie pastry recipes call for ice-cold butter in order to create the fakest layers. If your butter isn't the correct temperature, your bakes won't mix it up the way they should. Weigh all your ingredients. When it comes to baking, it's always preferable to measure your ingredients by weight rather than volume. This ensures you get exactly the right proportions. It might not be critical for something simple like a pan of blondies, but it's important with fussier baked items such as macaroons. Chill the cookie dough. We know how tempting it is to get your cookies in the oven the second you're done mixing up your dough. However, chilling the dough can help develop flavors and prevent cookies from spreading too much. Do not skip this step. Number 5. Coat mix-ins with flour. When a recipe calls for add-in dried fruits, chocolate chips, and or nuts, you'll often see instructions to toss them in a bit of flour before adding to the batter. You might think that's a waste. After all, there's flour in the batter. But coating these heavy mix-ins helps prevent them from sticking to the bottom of the pan. Now, that's interesting. The extra step gives you even distribution and a prettier result. Cool cakes completely before frosting. Always let your cakes, cupcakes, and cookies cool completely before frosting them. If they are too warm, the frosting will slide right off the top of your cake and melt and soak in. Cooling racks speed up the process. If you don't have one, Take the cover off your ironing board and use the board as a cooling rack. Now, I'm going to throw a little personal thing in here. Yesterday, I baked a loaf of bourbon bread. I saw a recipe for two-ingredient bread, and this is about the fourth one I've done, and they all turn out delicious. All it is ice cream and self-rising flour. It's a pint of ice cream and a cup and a half of self-rising flour. You let the ice cream come to room temperature, and then you add the flour, mix it up, bake it in the oven, and you can look this up online. There's a pretty common recipe. But what I used was Häagen-Dazs's new spirits ice cream, they call it, which are infused with either bourbon or whiskey. There's also one with rum and stuff. The one I used was bourbon. And the interesting thing is you get the taste of bourbon, but not strongly. And actually, it actually seems to taste better after you've eaten it. You can taste the bourbon. Very interesting. It was fun. 9 squeaky clean ways to get angry. 9, Jesus, Mary, and Joseph. Whoa. 7, hold your horses. 6, geez Louise. 5, for heaven's sake. 4, if I had a nickel for every time. 3, well now wait a minute. 2, for Pete's sake. 1, listen here, pal. Your true stories. Birds of a feather. I've been in the construction business for many years. When I was a foreman on a job site, 2 members of my crew who always rode together were often late for work. I gave them their last warning. A few days later, one of them came in late and said to me, "Boss, I'm sorry, but my parakeet died last night and I had to bury him." Being an animal lover, I excused his lateness. A couple minutes later, his buddy came straggling in. His excuse? I was one of the pallbearers. History in translation. The road ahead curves under a thick canopy of trees. I'm in Germany. It's 2004. As I drive around the bend, 2 dozen Confederate soldiers walk out of the brush. I look in my rearview mirror. Yes, there are Confederate soldiers carrying muskets. I'm overrunned down and yell, "Was macht da du, Kumpel?" What are you doing, pal? They yell back, "Gettysburg." It turns out reenacting the American Civil War is a thing in Germany. Who knew that? Learning is sweet. As a first grade reading teacher, I had to test students at the beginning of the school year to determine their reading levels. Part of the assessment was having them read a sheet with upper and lowercase letters randomly ordered. One of the students I was testing came to a lowercase M. He looked at it and looked at it. Finally, he turned to me and said, "I've seen the letter on M&Ms, but I don't know what it's called." And with that, we're going to switch over to Consumer Reports. Making cars safer for women. Women are at a higher risk of injury or death in a car crash, and yet auto safety testing is still geared almost exclusively toward men. Why have safety regulators and automakers continue to ignore women, and what must be done to provide better protection? The face of a crash test dummy looks eerily vacant, with indents instead of eyes, a pointy nose, and permanently pursed lips. It appears remarkably expressionless, especially considering it's about to hurtle toward a stationary barrier at speeds as high as 40 miles per hour. You might assume from its lack of distinguishing features that a crash test dummy is an avatar for all humanity. But beside the blank faces, most of the dummies used in automotive crash tests by the government and the insurance industry, the test to determine whether a car gets coveted 5-star safety rating or is named a top safety pick, represents a very specific man. Even though female and male bodies react differently in crashes, an average adult female crash test dummy simply does not exist. Despite the fact that women obviously drive to work, take road trips, and ride in cars with friends, that absence has set the course for 4 decades worth of car safety design, with deadly consequences. Although the majority of Americans killed or injured in car crashes are male, the raw data makes the fact that females are actually at greater risk of death or injury when a crash occurs. Data from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, the NHTSA, and the Federal Highway Administration, FHWA, show that males drive more miles than females and are more likely to engage in risky behaviors such as speeding, driving under the influence of alcohol, and not wearing a seatbelt. But a study from NHTSA shows that a female driver or front passenger who is wearing her seatbelt is 17% more likely than a male to be killed when a crash takes place. And a 2019 study from the University of Virginia shows that a female occupant, the odds of being injured in a frontal crash are 73% greater than the odds for a male occupant. That's controlling for That's controlling for occupant age, height, and body mass index, in addition to collision severity and vehicle model year. These alarming numbers suggest the urgent safety issue, but the problem is neither new nor unfamiliar to regulators and automakers. These same trends have been observed in many, many studies in the past, says Jason Foreman, Ph.D., who is a principal scientist at the Center for Applied Biomechanics at UVA and led the 2019 study of injury disparities. In fact, researchers have understood since the early 1980s that male and female bodies perform differently in crashes, but the vast majority of automotive safety policy and research is still designed to address the body of the so-called 50th percentile male, currently represented in crash tests by a 171-pound, 5-foot-9-inch dummy that was first standardized in the 1970s. Today, the average American is about 26 pounds heavier. Regulators asked for a female dummy in 1980, and a group of automakers positioned for one in 1996. But it took in 2003 for NHTSA to put one in the car. Even then, it's just a scaled-down version of a male dummy that represents only the smallest 5% of women by the standards of the mid-1970s. So small that it can work double duty as a 12- or 13-year-old child. Furthermore, no dummy takes into account the biological difference between male and female bodies. In frontal crash tests performed by both NHTSA and the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, IIHS, the fifth percentile female dummy either rides as a passenger or doesn't participate in the test at all. The female dummy sits in the driver's seat for some side impact tests. This, despite the fact that women now represent almost 50% of drivers in the U.S., according to the FHWA. Because the automotive design is directly influenced by the results of safety testing, any bias in the way cars are crash tested translates into the way cars are manufactured. So if safety tests don't prioritize female occupants, car makers won't necessarily make changes to better protect them. The reality of progress in automotive safety is that heavily relies on regulations, says Emily Thomas, Ph.D., automotive safety engineer at Consumer Reports Auto Test Center. Unless the federal motor vehicle safety standards require dynamic crash testing with average-sized female crash dummies in multiple seating positions, driver's side included, the dummy industry and the automakers won't make that leap themselves. The three stages of a crash. Automotive safety experts took a look at car crashes in three distinct stages. The first stage is the vehicle crash, the impact of a car or truck into a foreign object. Stage two is a human crash, when the bodies of the vehicle's occupants come into contact with seat belts and airbags, or worse, the dashboard, windows, or some other object. The third stage is the internal crash, which refers to the collision of organs, bones, and soft tissue that happen within the human body. According to Consumer Reports, the crash energy that is absorbed by the vehicle in that first stage is then transferred to the occupants. Vehicle restraint systems like seat belts and airbags are intended to limit motion and transfer energy, he says. But to do that, you effectively across a large range of body types. Car makers and crash testers need to consider not just the size difference of occupants, but also the material properties of their bodies. That means crash testing cars with dummies that presents a variety of body types, Thomas says, and ones that account for physiological differences between males and females. Females are not just smaller versions of males, says Christy Arbogast, Ph.D., the co-scientific director of the Center for Injury Research and Prevention at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, who also sits on the board of the Association for the Advancement of Automotive Medicine. They're put together differently. Their material properties, their structure is different. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, today's average woman is 5.4 inches shorter and 27 pounds lighter than the average man. As a result, women may sit closer to the steering wheel or wear their seat belts differently from men. But differences aren't just about shape, size, and position. For example, the geometry of the female pelvis is different from the male pelvis, and the male neck can better withstand forces and bend it. Even the internal makeup of female bones can be different from that of male bones. Because crash injuries and fatalities are often related to bone fractures, this may explain some of the disparities between the sexes. Biomechanical engineers and anthropologists are still struggling to understand other biological variations between male and female bodies that determine how they will react in a car crash. Crashes are chaotic events, and even two occupants of the same height, weight, and sex may experience a crash differently. Research shows that in addition to women, elderly vehicle occupants are also more vulnerable in a crash, as are large drivers and occupants. But there are specific differences in how male and female bodies react to crashes, and in some cases the cause is unclear. Consider whiplash. Women are up to 3 times more likely to suffer whiplash injuries than men, but real-world crash data shows that many vehicle seats specifically designed to prevent whiplash injuries are actually less likely to help female occupants. In the late 1990s, automakers developed 2 kinds of safety systems designed to protect against whiplash. One, used primarily by Volvo, is designed to absorb crash injury in the seat back and head restraint. It reduced life-altering whiplash injuries for both male and female occupants, but provided to be slightly more effective for females. Toyota used a similar design. The other design, used by many other manufacturers, uses only a moving head restraint to diminish the movement of the head and neck and impacts. Though it reduces life-altering whiplash crash injuries up to 70% for male occupants, it has no benefit for females. It's an open secret in automotive industry that automakers engineer their cars specifically to pass crash tests. That's why it's critical for tests to represent how cars are used in the real world. When regulators or testing organizations set a new bar for crash safety, most automakers quickly change their designs so that their cars ace the new tests, says David Friedman, Vice President of Advocacy at Consumer Reports and a former NHTSA administrator. That's what happened in 2012 when IIHS, an independent crash testing agency, funded by the insurance companies, asked a new evaluation, the small overlap test. The test simulates a crash where the front driver's side corner of a vehicle collides with another vehicle or a tree or utility pole. As soon as the test was announced, some automakers began redesigning the next generation of vehicles to score well by improving vehicle structures and airbags. But those changes were made only to the driver's side of the vehicle, where that test was targeted. That prompted the IIHS to introduce a passenger-side version of the test in late 2017. For the current model year, every one of those cars tested in 2012 now gets a good or acceptable score thanks to the design changes. When asked why it doesn't use an average adult female dummy in its testing, an NHTSA spokesperson provided a written statement to CR saying that the agency already addresses inequality in crash outcomes by requiring the use of a 5/5 percentile female dummy. The agency's use of a 5th percentile female and a 50th percentile male dummies represents a broad spectrum of occupant crash protection rather than merely focusing on median body types, its statement said. Currently, NHTSA is focusing its research in new advancements in both size of crash test dummies, including the use of advanced instrumentation and criteria designed to better mitigate respective injury risk. The Auto Alliance, a trade group that represents many large automakers in the U.S., told CR that the group does not believe that a 50th percentile female dummy would significantly change any real-world restraint system designs. A spokesman for the group wrote in an email. Decades of delays. NHTSA said the IIHS and the IIHS are both evaluating a new set of dummies called THOR, or Test Device for Human Occupant Restraint. They have been in development since the 1980s and may be used in European crash tests as soon as this year. They'll be able to collect more data than the current dummies, known as the Hybrid 3 series, and the 5th percentile female version of THOR dummy has been designed to better mimic an actual human female body. However, there are currently no plans for average female THOR. Even the regulators demand one today. Researchers would first need to collect real-world injury data from female occupants to identify patterns which injury happens most often, which are most severe. Then they would have to recreate those specific patterns and mechanisms in the laboratory with animals or human cadavers, a process experts say could take at least 20 years. Building a dummy doesn't necessarily take that long, says Becky Mueller, a senior research engineer at the IIHS. But to be able to relate what the dummy is measuring back to real-world injuries takes years and years of real-world data collection. Astrid Linder, Ph.D., a professor at Chalmers University in Sweden and the research director of traffic safety at the Swedish National Road and Transport Institute, agrees that the length of time it could take to build a female dummy is frustrating, but she said that is not an excuse for delaying the work further. This was the answer I got 20 years ago when I did a review as a PhD student, she says. There's no data that isn't possible to collect. Go ahead and do it. We know how to do it. Linder has been leading efforts in Europe to address the differences in crash outcomes between male and female vehicle occupants. She says that we need to start work on an average female dummy to determine what information we don't know. If you wait for all the data to be available, then we will wait forever, she says. One way that automakers and safety advocates are addressing inequality in the short term is by developing computer models that can stimulate how human bodies of different shapes, sizes, or sexes react in a crash. This approach is already in use by some automakers, including Toyota and Volvo. Volvo developed a computer model of an average pregnant female in the early 2000s, and it worked with Chalmers University to create a computer model of an average-sized female to develop its whiplash protection, the very same one that prevents injury equally for both men and women. If you want to run a crash test, you have to build a car first, then you have to spend time to instrument it, and then you have to put the dummy in and run the test, says Jason Hallman, Ph.D., a principal engineer in Toyota's research and development department. If you want to, say, shift the posture or put in a different size dummy, you have to do the process all over again. By comparison, Hallman says that running a test with a computer model of a human body can take about a week, although the underlying research behind that model often represents years of work. Linder says she expects computer models to become more prevalent, but she emphasizes that virtual human is responsible for no substitute for an actual dummy. As long as we humans are the ones using the cars, then we need to confirm in physical testing that this is actually representing the physical world, she says. Therefore, those physicians' physical tests must also include female dummies. If you exclude half of the occupants, you can only confirm half of them, what you have done in the company's world that corresponds to the physical world, she says. The lessons in deadly airbags. Collecting the data and reengineering America's crash test to be better representative of female occupants could take decades. But with the right motivation, there's a chance that changes could be accelerated. That's what happened in the late 1990s, when safety regulators and researchers took just 2 years to fix an airbag issue that was killing children and smaller women. Between 1996 and 2000, 179 people, including 118 children, were killed by airbags in low-speed crashes that shouldn't have been fatal. Physicians, automakers, and safety advocates realized they had a problem, and they suspected it had to do with airbags designed to be powerful enough to keep a 50th percentile male in the seat in a crash, even if he wasn't wearing a seatbelt, per federal safety regulations. I think that really highlighted how to be far behind we were and how inadequate the testing had been for just assume that a 50th percentile male would be sitting there, Jackie Gillian says. Today, she's president emeritus of Advocates for Highway and Auto Safety, a group that lobbies for safety roads and better safety regulations. But in 1996, Gillian was the vice president of the organization, and she worked with automakers, legislators, regulators, and the families of those killed in crashes to help create safer airbags. In November 1996, NHTSA announced that it would make changes to airbag rules in response to the deaths. 4 months later, the agency relaxed testing requirements to allow automakers to rapidly design their airbags using a crash sled, which simulates a car crash instead of the costly, time-consuming crash tests of actual vehicles. Almost half the automakers reduced the power of their airbags between the 1997 and 1998 model years. By September of 1998, NHTSA required automakers to install advanced airbags, which deploy with a force proportional to the weight of the vehicle occupant. The strategy worked. Starting in 1998, fatalities due to airbags began decreasing appreciably. According to DeGillian, part of the reason for that swift action on airbags was a clear, perceptible harm. You have all the elements coming together where you had a problem of children being injured, public opinion, congressional interest, and a legal system that was not going to let this continue. By comparison, the issue of higher injury and fatality risk for women may feel more abstract and difficult to publicize. Although fixing an airbag is no easy task, it's not nearly as complex and nuanced as addressing the multiple factors that make women less safe in crashes. According to Ohio State's Manley Agnew, Ph.D., Many of the mechanisms behind different injury outcomes between men and women remain unexplored, as are injury risks for other vulnerable groups, such as the elderly and larger drivers and passengers. We have to do the basic science. We have to go back to the fundamentals, she says. At the same time, we can't wait for all of the answers to do anything. I think we need to do both in parallel actions. To start the process, the regulators such as NHTSA need to act, says Chalmers University's lender. If that happens, he estimates that the average female crash test dummy could be included in an official crash test by 2030. And the industry will take action, and society will take action, she says. But the starting point is those decisions made by regulatory bodies. Recent studies have gotten the political process moving. In November of last year, 4 months after Foreman released this UVA study, Congresswoman Kathy Castor of Florida and Jan Schimanowski of Illinois wrote to the acting administrator of NHTSA demanding action. NHTSA is failing in its mission if women are almost 75% more likely than men to die or receive a serious injury when they are involved in an automobile crash, Castor and Schimanowski wrote. This disparity is simply unacceptable, and we must act to stop the disproportionate harm to women in automobile crashes. For additional safety coverage on this topic, go to cr.org/carsafety. And the way men, and there's a chart here, ways women are at higher risk. Railroad crash data show that women are more likely to be injured in a car crash than men. But safety researchers are just beginning to understand why. And unless crash tests better prioritize women, some of the disparities will continue to be a mystery. Legs, 79.7% higher risk for injury than men. Female drivers are more likely than males to have leg injuries in a crash when the floor of the car deforms due to the crash forces transmitted through the gas or brake pedals. In the rear seats, female passengers are especially vulnerable to injuries when their legs collide with the backs of the front seats. Arms, 58.2% higher risk for injury than men. Female drivers are highly vulnerable to arm injuries in a crash due to contact with the steering wheel and or an airbag, and women in the rear seat are more likely than men to experience shoulder fractures. These injuries may not be life-threatening, but they can seriously impair the quality of life. Neck injuries, 44.7% higher risk for injury than men. The structures of the female spinal column is generally not as strong as the male's, but still has to support a head that weighs almost as much. In addition, many anti-whiplash head restraints are more effective for men than for women. Abdomen, 38.5% higher risk for injury than men. Data suggests that rear seat belts may be better at protecting men than women from abdominal injury. Still, wearing a seat belt is a lifesaver for all vehicle occupants, including women. Chest, 26.4% higher risk for injury than men, especially in the rear seat. Women are more vulnerable to chest injuries and rib fractures. Although researchers know that ribs differ due to factors such as age and sex, they are unsure how those differences translate to how they react to crash forces. Bones. The internal structure of female bones differ from male bones. Because crash injuries and fatalities are often related to bone fractures, this can explain some of the disparities between the sexes. Bones change over time, as well. People assume that bone is this dead, static structure in your body, but it's definitely not, says Mandy Agnew, Ph.D., a biological anthropologist and director of the Skeletal Biology Research Lab at The Ohio State University, Injury Biomechanics Research Center. That's a mouthful. It's sensing loads constantly and altering its size and shape to meet those it needs, so it's quite dynamic. Pelvis. The female pelvis has a different geometry than the male pelvis. That's one of the many reasons dummy designers can't simply change the external proportions of a male crash test dummy to turn it into an average female. It's important for crash test dummies to be biophilic, designed so that they mimic the human body in every way. In order to do so, safety researchers need to conduct tests using human cadavers. Pregnancy. Car crashes are the leading cause of traumatic fetal death in the U.S. Researchers have created computer models of crash test dummies to represent pregnant vehicle occupants, but those dummies are not yet included in consumer-facing crash tests. Okay, we're going to do some popping around here because we have a fair number of Consumer Report magazines that we haven't looked at because of the coronavirus, etc. So basically what I'm going to do right now is read a letter from the president of Consumer Reports, whose name is Marta Tolado. A Path Towards Sustainability, and this is from the June issue. As all of us continue to grapple with the ongoing consequences of uncertainty of COVID-19, we at CR are keeping one eye on the hazards that can threaten to similarly disrupt our lives down the road. One of the key lessons of the novel coronavirus is that we must act with urgency and fact-based planning to prepare ourselves for large-scale challenges, including the threat of climate change. With that in mind, we will be shining an even brighter light on how this can factor sustainability when we make choices in the marketplace by highlighting products and services that do not harm public health or the environment in their production, use, or disposal. Our cover story this month on the omnipresence of plastics in our environment underscores the health implications of more than 10 billion tons of plastic produced over the past decade. As we ramp up our insights and testing on sustainability, we'll be using the same rigorous evidence-based testing and reporting that you have come to depend on from CR. Our mission has always been to ensure your well-being and safety by equipping you with the trustworthy information you need to shift the marketplace toward better outcomes for yourself and for the world. We cannot prevent pandemics or undo all the harm that has been done to the environment. But working together, there are steps we can take today to shape our world for the better and preserve the planet for future generations. It took an enormous effort by the CR team while working remotely, full of resilience and dedication, to put together this issue, as I'm sure the subsequent issues as well. I hope you will find it useful and relevant. Remember to take good care of yourselves and your loved ones. COVID action for consumers. This is in March. Congress passed the legislation to address the economic impact of coronavirus pandemic, as they're still doing, and more federal, state, and local initiatives to mitigate damage are probably on the way. But we at CR believe it's vital that all efforts put people and not companies first. How CR has your back. CR began working with lawmakers before the $2 trillion package was signed. Our goal of ensuring that all coronavirus-related legislation be guided by a core set of principles, fairness, safety, and transparency for consumers, is backed by more than the 76,000 people who signed a CR petition in early April. In a letter to congressional leaders, CR President Marta Tolato specifically called on Congress to protect consumers from deceptive products, scams, and abusive practices related to the pandemic, prevent surprise medical bills, including COVID-19 treatments, provide people facing financial hardship temporary waivers for rent, mortgage, and other debt payments, prohibit utilities and Internet providers from cutting off services or charging late fees during the crisis, and stop credit agencies from reporting negative data during the crisis. The federal relief package fulfilled some, but not means all of CR's aims, and our advocates will continue pushing to focus government efforts on consumer hardships. Safer auto safety systems. Most new cars and trucks today come equipped with high-tech features that help avoid crashes. CR recommends that buyers seek key safety features such as automatic emergency braking with pedestrian detection when they shop. But if we have serious concerns about other features, Tesla's autopilot, for example, can steer, brake, and adjust speeds in certain conditions, but besides what its name implies, requires drivers to stay engaged to safely operate a car. A recent study by the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety found that such systems need improvement to ensure that drivers can pay attention. How CR has your back. A freighter crash of Tesla Model X in California 2 years ago proves the point. A February report from the National Transportation Safety Board concluded that the car steered itself toward a highway exit ramp barrier, that the driver failed to react before the crash, and that the driver's phone was playing a video game at the time of impact. What does that tell you? The NTSB said in its report that Tesla has failed to address the balance between claimed autonomy and real capabilities, and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration hasn't set standards that could prevent fatalities. So CR is calling for major improvements across the auto industry. Manufacturers and NTSA must make sure that these driver assistance systems come with safety features that actually verify drivers are monitoring the roads, says Ethan Douglas, CR polyanalyst. Saying no to toy magnets. Small children put all sorts of foreign objects in their mouth and unfortunately often end up swallowing them. Most simply pass through their digestive tracts, causing little or no harm. But doctors warn that a dangerous exception is tiny, high-powerful magnets. If a child swallows more than one of these super-strong rare-earth magnets, which are typically sold in sets, sometimes marketed as toys, The magnets can find each other inside the body and cause severe trauma. Emergency surgery may be needed to prevent holes in the intestine, infection, and other deadly problems. The Consumer Product Safety Commission reported an estimated 2,900 emergency room-treated cases and one death after ingestion of high-powered magnets from 2009 to 2013. How CR has your back. CR and other safety groups successfully pushed to limit sales of magnets in 2014, but a company challenged the standard in court and won. The restrictions were invalidated in November 2016. Since then, annual reports of ingestion have increased sixfold, says the American Association of Poison Control Centers. That's why doctors and consumer advocates, including CR, are endorsing a bill to Congress to ban the magnets. Let's close out with a couple of letters to the editor concerning the Leafy Green Safety Guard. Regarding leafy greens, a discussion should be brought up about radiation eradicating produce. The Food and Drug Administration has approved it for two types of leafy produce. You can argue that having the ability to prevent spoilage is an important contribution to enhancing food security. Which is worse, getting a package with a label saying it has been irradiated or getting salmonella? The FDA has approved irradiation for spinach and iceberg lettuce. Though it doesn't necessarily eliminate all bacteria, it could kill or reduce the types of bacteria that cause foodborne illness. But it's not a substitute for proper sanitation, agriculture, and food handling practices. What's more, there's some research suggests that irradiation at high doses enough to have an impact would make the greens limp and soggy. Let's close out with a real quick vital statistic. 9. The number of additional feet it takes a hybrid sedan to stop on drive pavement versus a non-hybrid version of the same model. Hybrid SUVs take an average of 4 additional feet. That's kind of interesting. And some affordable cars with advanced systems, the Kia Forte, the Hyundai Elantra, the Toyota Corolla, and the Mazda 3. All of those are between $20,000 and $25,000 in cost, and they have advanced safety features that will save your life. Well, with that, we've just about run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next week, and thanks so much for listening.